Today's episode of The Compendium was sponsored by Critical Dice. Stick around for a special offer at the end of the show.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
All right, welcome back to The Compendium. We are doing another episode on race, and we are trying to gear ourselves up because this one is going to be a doozy. We had a special request on our Instagram account to do tieflings. And so that's what we're going to do this week. Thank you, Layla Rogue, for your suggestion. But we did not realize when we tossed around the idea of doing tieflings that it is a ginormously substantial, huge race.
It is.
And so this episode is going to span a little bit longer than the other race episodes had, just so we can actually talk about everything.
Yeah, because we were originally going to do this when you were like, yeah, it'll be kind of short. I wonder if it'll be long enough. And then we started looking into it and we were like, oh, good. There's a kind of tiefling for every layer of hell. And then some. Awesome.
Yeah, and the thing is there, I mean, this is why this can be so confusing and why I didn't think there was much to them at first, was that there's none of that information in the player's handbook. You have to actually go to Mordekainen's in order to find that. Or and, Sword Coast Adventure.
Yes, or go to the best hidden gem in all of D&D, the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, yes.
Yeah, so they're kind of like dotted throughout D&D lore and information manuals. And so you might have to hunt around to find them. But luckily, we're going to summarize all of them for you here today to hopefully clarify some of that information. So before we get started into kind of like the traits and some of the playable features of playing a tiefling, we really need to unpack what tieflings are and the lore that's behind them, because in my opinion, this race has probably one of the richest backstories of most of the D&D races. I don't know if you'd agree with me on that, Jason, but...
Well, I know that you're a big fan, and there certainly is a lot of lore there. I think here, and probably with Dragonborn as well, there's a lot of misconceptions about the tiefling race option in D&D. And so, I think there is a lot to cover.
Yeah. So why don't we just start with, you know, what tieflings are, kind of usually what they look like, and then from there go into, well, why do they look like that, and the history and the culture and some other things that surround the race.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff all stems from the same thing. And at the outset, what we have to say is that tieflings are not demons.
Right.
They are not devils. They're humanoids. And they're not demons. And Grandpa wasn't a demon, but Grandpa consorted with demons. The idea with tieflings is that somewhere back in their lineage, someone cut a deal with one of the lords of the Nine Hells. And as a result, their bloodline has been, it depends on who you ask, either infused or tainted with this magic from the Nine Hells. And so that's why they look the way they do and why they are now this kind of more or less common but yet more exotic race with kind of innate and magical ability because of a deal from a long, long time ago. So that's kind of like the real important thing going on there.
Right. A lot of people like cosplaying tieflings, I feel like, because there's so much to work with the skin tones, the eyes, you know, the horns, some different attributes that you can work in. And I feel like there's a lot of room to even homebrew from the canon material, because, again, you're playing on this idea of like, your family's bloodline has kind of been cursed. And so how that might look could vary widely. And I think it'd be really easy to justify anything you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. When it comes to cosplay, it might be one of the more difficult ones, except again, for maybe Dragonborn, but man, are people really good at it. Like the people who do well, it's just fascinating to watch. Like I can be at a convention in the before times and see someone dressed as an elf. Cool, whatever. But when a tiefling walks by, you're like, yeah.
right?
That's awesome. Because, you know, a lot of work went into it and a lot of customization. And so, I mean, getting into that, like, so when it comes to tieflings, tieflings are the first of the races we've talked about that don't have their own kingdom in at least the Forgotten Realms, a kingdom of you know, infernal creatures like the tieflings would be an awesome idea for building your own homebrew world. But as it is in the Forgotten Realms and D&D 5e, they don't have their own homelands. They are just a people without a home. And so they're just going to be mixed in with other things. They're going to be part of any kind of homogenous society that you'd find on the Sword Coast. And it's because it kind of came from a family or a couple of families that had dealings with devils, and now they look like this, and that's genetic. So it's being passed on from parent to child over the generations. And so because of this kind of heritage is pretty well known, they often suffer from a lot of prejudice, and they suffer from a lot of like whispers and just not really trusting them outright off the bat. Although there are plenty of examples of good tieflings, of virtuous and even heroic tieflings around, it's just they don't get a break on the outset, or they don't get the benefit of the doubt oftentimes. It's like being from House Slytherin, right? It doesn't mean that you're evil, but everyone evil always came from your house, right? Right. It's kind of the logic that they're logic in air quotes that they're using when dealing with tieflings. And so it, as a result, it makes many tieflings therefore suspicious of other people. And once they have close friends, great, but there's a to put our first Emperor's New Groove reference, there's a wall there. And once you're past that first wall, they will have, you know, tight, close, kind of found family relationships once they kind of know that, you know, people can be trusted. And so that's kind of the big defining feature, you know, socially when it comes to tieflings.
Right. And I know that when we were talking with Keith in our episode discussing with him about his method for the monsters know what they're doing, one of his things that he mentioned was that he very rarely, if at all, lets players play tieflings because of the fact that they have this prejudice against them. And so he'll have, you know, if you remember, he said he has a sit down conversation with that player to be like, look, this is going to cause some major issues for you in game. Are you sure you want to do this? And I think that's really interesting too, from a DM perspective as well, that idea of like, well, there's more to this than meets the eye, and that lore and that concept behind it will bleed out into the campaign if you let it, or if the DM wants it to. And so it can really come into play in a lot of different respects.
Yeah, absolutely. But every campaign is different. And so Keith has chosen to really kind of stick to the established lore. But in your own game, you could just choose that, yeah, people are a little suspicious, but it's not like they're going to, you know, shoot you dead in the streets or refuse you service or something because you walk in as a tiefling. So, I mean, you can kind of play with that slider and put it as far one direction or another as you want to. So it really, I think, is good to sit down and have that conversation with your player, or sit down and have a conversation with your DM about what you're getting yourself into, like Keith does with his players, because he knows how he conceives of tieflings in social interactions in his world. So I think it's really important with almost everything when it comes to D&D is have that honest conversation before the game starts, but especially when you're getting into things like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I like tieflings so much is they're kind of like the underdog. And there's that layer to them that is there's more than meets the eye. So people make assumptions about, you know, the quality of character of these individuals or some other aspects, which could be completely untrue. I mean, this could be a divine cleric from, you know, a very good domain. Like they might have like some of the most holy attributes or good attributes, but people are going to see them and make judgments off the bat. And for some reason, something about that kind of fighting against the status quo, that just really appeals to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because once they kind of realize maybe the whole world's against me, what then do you do? Do you just go with the flow and say, fine, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make your assumptions about me be worse than you ever could imagine, or I'm going to prove you wrong and make you feel bad about, you know, assuming this about me, because there's something implicit. And it says it here in the player's handbook too, is that it's not just that you bear the mark of the infernal on your skin, you're bearing it in your morality and your personality as well, which is just not true, according to the player's handbook. And so it gives you a lot of great opportunities to work with that extreme when it comes to role play. And what's interesting too is we don't often talk about like common names for different races, but they talk specifically in here, and I think this is a great kind of follow-up, is that they also will choose virtue names. They'll choose names that kind of represent their outlook on life, whether they're kind of leaning into it in the mistrust, or they're working hard to cause reform and change and to change people's minds. And so their names could be anything from despair and carry on to poetry and quest and reverence and hope, which is kind of fun too. And I don't see that element used too much in role play at the tables that I'm aware of. And I wish they would more, because it's kind of a fun little mechanic that's baked right into the race.
Yeah, it has a very, it is reminiscent, I think, of Catholicism. In some ways, how I know that, or I believe, I might be wrong with this, but how a lot of times nuns or other, you know, religious people will assume a name that is different from their like birth name, mm-hmm. that represents, you know, who they are, or, you know, somebody that they're honoring or something like that.
Right. I mean,
and so it feels very like that of like, you know, I am making a choice that this is the thing I'm going to strive for, or anything I want to represent.
Right, or choose to affiliate myself with. I think when you see a new pope be chosen, he always takes a new name, and it's usually a name of a previous pope over the last, you know, almost 2,000 years. And they're choosing to affiliate themselves with the works, deeds, and moralities of that previous name holder. And so, yeah, I like that idea. You know, or having a, you know, someone be like, we have nicknames in our real world too, where we call people, you know, things like Tiny or Sunny, or here in New Mexico, like Flaca or something like that, you know, where you're kind of gently making fun of them. And that's why you have big guys who are called Tiny. My friend Pilar from Colombia calls me Pelon, which is baldy, and it's a term of endearment, and I wear it proudly. So there's a lot of fun stuff there.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the, in the player's handbook, descriptions of what a tiefling can look like. Again, I feel like it can vary wildly, but I have also seen some pretty hot debates on the internet about like the color of tiefling skin that it's like, it's not in the player's handbook, but I'm on team, you know, it's a game that's for fun. You do you. But let's kind of go over what the player's handbook presents so that we can give people a feel for kind of the vibe that Wizards is trying to create here.
Yeah, exactly. I think you started that off perfectly. Do what you want, but here's what the book says. So, the big features about tieflings that make them so distinct and so noteworthy is they have a couple of features. They have usually horns, and this could be anything from like really small, almost like satyr like horns. Others might have like big, like circling, like, you know, mountain ram horn kind of things going on. Others can be really like slender and tall and kind of have a gentle arch back like a gazelle. And others can just be really like really, really small or even close to the head that don't curve quite as much. I've seen depictions like that in even official art, which is kind of nice. And then, of course, they also typically have tails. Think Nightcrawler from the X-Men. If you've never seen a tiefling, just think about Nightcrawler from the X-Men.
Right.
He's a stinking tiefling, except for the horns. Or if you want to think of a beefier version, think of Hellboy from the comics and movies. He's got all the same features as well. And so they have these tails, usually 4 to 5 feet long, which is really long. It'll kind of like wrap around like their leg, or you'll see it kind of flick like a cat does when they get annoyed or something. And they're not exactly prehensile, meaning they can't like grab something off the ground with it or use it to open a door. I don't think that there's enough fine motor control in the way it's described to grab something, or even necessarily enough strength to pull a door open. However, that is a cool thing to homebrew with your DM. I think that's really awesome.
Well, the cool thing with both of those traits that just came to mind as you were talking, like, you know, you can't really use it. It's like, if this is really like tainted bloodline, you're cursed in a sense. Like, you're cursed with two of these most vivid attributes that are essentially useless to you, other than just making you obvious to having this like tainted bloodline.
Right.
The horns, they're not going to be strong enough in most cases to like be like a ram and like headbutt somebody in battle,
or and a minotaur and like gore somebody.
And so I think it harkens back to that idea of like, this, these physical traits are there to kind of set you up as a reminder that your family did something way back when. They're not there to actually help you.
It's all of the distinction without any of the difference. It's pretty good. Then also too, they usually have kind of sharpened canine teeth, kind of like almost like a vampire, not quite. And then here's where all the controversy comes. Everyone's cool with all this other stuff. The eyes are always solid colors: black, red, white, silver, or gold, with no visible pupil or the kind of the white part like we would see in most humans. And that's a pretty broad range. I like that. I don't think I've heard too much crazy stuff out of beyond those. Mm-hmm. And then the skin tone cover. Here, I think this is where the problem comes. They cover the full range of human coloration. Okay. So that's there, which also includes various shades of red. So any color a human being can be, plus all the shades of red, including like just straight up Hellboy red.
But yeah, and I think a lot of people make purple tieflings, which is where a lot of the battle comes in.
like fuchsia and magenta and the straight up purple ones, or light blue, like Jester from Critical Role. Like, you're like, okay, cool. And I think that might be the problem, is that when it comes to like the flavor like that, like Matt didn't hold Laura to like, oh no, here's the only colors you can have. And people who came into the hobby through Critical Role, which is great, didn't know that that wasn't like normal. I wasn't like the, like kind of the standard. And so they just went with it. And then now we have these two kind of dissenting opinions in the community, which is kind of interesting. And then the hair, like this as well, kind of cascading behind the horns, usually dark browns and blacks, but also dark red, blue, and purple. And so it's just like, you know what, at this point, all of that is so buck wild, just do what you want. But
yeah, I mean, there's so much variety there to begin with. Like, it's just, yeah, it's very amusing to me. But like, it's just, it's really fun. There's a lot there to play with. And I think you could, even if you really wanted to dig deep into the concept here, you could do something out of that doesn't align with the player's handbook. Mm-hmm. And then the DM could roll it into the campaign where people like see this tiefling that's not a, a normal color tiefling. And then that, does that spark even more fear, or does it let them be like, okay, well, maybe you're okay? Like, does it change the dynamics when you start to present these different characteristics? Like, I feel like there's so much room for creativity there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, maybe your character thinks that, you know, this is normal, and then starts adventuring and realizes that no one has ever seen a tiefling quite like that. It's like in The Mandalorian, where he's like, Mandalorians don't take off their helmets ever. And then literally every Mandalorian he ever meets in two seasons, the first thing they do is take off their helmets. And he's like, wait, maybe I'm the weird one, right?
Yeah.
So spoilers for Mandalorian, sorry. So maybe it's like that. And so again, there's plenty of ways to make this work. There's, I can see very little reason to be such a stickler on this kind of stuff. And I say go for it.
So with that in mind about kind of the idea of tiefling origin and some visual concepts of what they look like, so you have a picture of what a tiefling could visualize as in your head, let's actually talk about their traits, like the actual playable traits that you benefit from when you as a player are using a character that's a tiefling.
Right. So the tiefling traits are pretty great. They're like up there, I think, with like elves and such, with the number of things that are there. And there's a conceit in the player's handbook that this tieflings have made a deal with Asmodeus, the Lord of the Nine Hells, or Asmodeus.
Yeah, also,
if you prefer.
Disclaimer, we don't know if we're pronouncing any of these names right. So we're just going to like out ourselves first that if we say this wrong, I'm not going to be surprised.
So Asmodeus and Asmodeus are both official. I'll just put that out there. I say Asmodeus because Asmodeus has a nice flourish to it, but it's slower in conversation. So I say Asmodeus. And those are my reasons, and I'll die on this hill. Kidding. You can at me. So this is by default kind of like the Asmodeus version of the tiefling, and we'll in a minute get into like all the other versions that we've discovered in our research, but at the stock model, the factory setting default, is an intelligence score goes up by 1 and the charisma score goes up by 2, which is great because almost all non-divine casters use either intelligence or charisma as their spellcasting attribute. And so that makes them really great being spellcasters. And that's how I typically see them being played, although there are plenty of roguish versions of tieflings as well.
And I love how those play into like what we talked about with just their existence, because you have to be smart if people aren't going to trust you. You have to kind of have that those street smarts. And then with charisma, people just naturally look at you and they're intimidated. Because again, charisma isn't just like a performance on a stage. It's intimidation. It's some of those other side effects. And you just, your existence exudes that.
Yeah, exactly. Just like we talked about the cosplayers, they walk by and we're like, what?
Yeah.
Because they have that bonus to charisma. And so everyone notices them. Their age, they're very similar to humans. They mature at the same rate, but they can live a few years longer. It doesn't really say how long, but it's like human plus. And then alignment, they do not have an innate tendency towards evil. But many of them end up there, going back to our Slytherin reference before. But basically, they are going to lean towards chaotic because the law and order and all these things have never really helped them in the past. Why start now? So chaotic is kind of the leaning going there. Similar builds to humans, not surprising since they've come from humans. Size is medium, and the base walking speed is 30 feet like most medium-sized creatures. And then we get into the fun stuff. They have dark vision, so they can see in dim light within 60 feet as if it were bright light, and in darkness if it was dim light. And as always, they can't see color in darkness, just shades of gray. Then they also have resistance to fire damage, which makes perfect sense. And then they have something really cool called Infernal Legacy. And so this is some innate spell casting that levels up with the character, not because of its class, but because of the race. So they know the Thaumaturgy cantrip, which is from the cleric spell list, which lets them do spooky seance stuff, basically.
Yeah, it's like you get your choice of like 5 different little like prestidigitation type random tricks that you can do, which I think are actually awesome because you can like throw your voice and like send whispers or screams somewhere else, like things that can't actually hurt somebody.
Shut and open windows.
Like, yeah, it's great.
I call it the seance spell because if you go back and look at the list and think about someone who's like a huckster or a charlatan doing a seance, this is the one spell you need, and you're golden. You're going to be on
TV. And it's
a
cantrip, so you can do it for the entire seance.
Yeah, exactly. It's so good. And then when they reach third level, they can cast Hellish Rebuke as a second level spell, which is a reaction. So basically, if someone hits you with a melee attack, you can spend your reaction right then to engulf them in flame with your own personal notashi. Then at fifth level, they can cast Darkness once again with this trait, and all of those recharge on a long rest, and Charisma, of course, is a spellcasting ability for those. And then languages, they can speak, read, and write Common and Infernal.
What else speaks infernal offhand, you know? Because that's more of a unique one. Like, that's not something that many races are necessarily going to have, right?
No. Devils. They're the only ones who speak it naturally. There are other like, you know, races in monster listings that have infernal on there, but it's devils basically, because demons speak abyssal, which is different than infernal, but they're both bad news. So it's kind of clearly marked. It's not like primordial where it's like there's a lot of options there, or sylvan, and infernal is just the devil tongue. It's parcel tongue. No, it's devil tongue. try not to lean too much into the Harry Potter there. But yeah, so infernal. And I love too that since we know the lore that they don't have like homelands, and they'll live in little pockets of other societies or perhaps little enclaves, but they are infused with this infernal power. It's not like they're practicing, you know, cult members. It's not like they're teaching their kids infernal as they grow up, because that would only make things worse. What this implies to me is they're just genetically predisposed as a result of this mark to just know infernal.
It's like that story, that news story a long time ago that I heard, where somebody like went into a coma or got knocked unconscious, and when they woke up, they could speak fluent Mandarin.
Yes.
And it was just like this medical anomaly, because like they had no affiliation with that country.
Right, because they live in Texas. Yeah.
Yeah. And like that's what it reminds me of. It's like, how do I know this? I don't know. It just comes to me.
Well, like in the Percy Jackson series, all of the demigods, they have a dyslexia because their brains are hardwired to read ancient Greek. And trying to read something else kind of messes it up. And so, like, you know, he goes to a museum and there's like all the inscriptions on all the old statues and carvings and stuff. And he can just read it. And he's like, oh, okay, cool. So it's kind of like that. That's what that implies to me. It doesn't explicitly say it, but that's what makes sense to me, which I think is kind of cool.
And then going back real quick, you mentioned this, but I just want to clarify it with the Infernal Legacy, some of those like kind of magical traits that you get. With the exception of the Thaumaturgy, the other ones you can only do once per long rest.
Right.
So it's not like normal casting where you're necessarily tracking spell slots, or you can do it a couple of times. The Thaumaturgy is a cantrip, so you are able to just do it over and over and over and over again, from my understanding. But the other two, you do it one time before you sleep, and that's all you get. And so it's kind of one of those like Hail Marys for both of these things, in my opinion, of like, you don't use it unless you really need it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also, it's one per each of those spells. So it's not like if you cast Hellish Rebuke as this feature, that means it shuts off your opportunity to do darkness later. You can do each one of them individually once per long rest. So, yeah.
And so those are the every tiefling has them traits.
This is why
I got so confused, is because I looked in the player's handbook and you have a grand total of page 42 and 43 of tieflings and then nothing else. And I was like, oh my gosh, they don't even have subraces. But no, they just threw all of them into Mordekainen's. So everything we've talked about up until this point, you can find in the player's handbook. Everything we're about to talk about, you're going to need to reference some other guides like Mordekainen's or Sword Coast Adventures to kind of get some of that information from.
Right. And so what's different about this is it's not strictly speaking a subrace. Because so far when we talked
about... Okay, oh my gosh, yay, wizards, we're getting back into the confusion that we love so much.
Yes. So before what we... Yeah, this is our bread and butter of like, let me explain this really obtuse thing to you. So far when we looked at races, it'll say, okay, here's what all gnomes get, or all elves get, or all dwarves get. And then in addition, when you pick your subrace, you get these other things too. This is different. This is, there's a lot of similarities, but this replaces everything else instead. And the reason for it is, and some things do still stick, but the reason for it is the conceit in the player's handbook was that Asmodeus was the progenitor of this curse bloodline. Here in Mordekainen's, it's assuming that one of the other lords of one of the levels of the Nine Hells is the progenitor of this cursed bloodline, or the cause rather. So they start going through the different levels of hell and the different lords of hell and saying, well, if your tiefling came from a family that struck a deal with, say, for instance, Beelzebub, then it's different. And it'll give you a different set of ability score increases and a different kind of level up in inherent magic, which replaces everything that you had instead of Infernal Legacy.
So unlike the other races, are any other races like this? Or is this the only one that you can think of?
It's the only one I can think of, but I reserve the right to be wrong later.
We reserve the right to redact that statement.
Yes.
So this is going to be potentially the only one, or one of the only ones that don't layer. So you're not going to get both. You're going to get either or, based off of whichever god is, or demon, not god.
Well, is kind of the Asmodeus origin. Likes to think he is, but he's not. So this is unique in that way that it does replace the Infernal Legacy section. And oftentimes, again, it replaces that ability score increase. So let's start just, you know, alphabetically, I guess. And let's look at Beelzebub.
Yeah, because we already went over the first one.
Yeah, Asmodeus. Yeah.
And so we'll move back down to the next one that is on there.
Yeah,
so many weird words in this.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to let you butcher them so that I don't have to.
Okay, so Beelzebub is the ruler of Maledomini, one of the layers of hell. And his whole thing, his whole vibe is that he loves corrupting people who start out not as terrible sinners, but rather he uses those like just the kind of the normal sins of people as a starting point to help tip them over the edge into truly, truly terrible things. And so he is related to the idea of corruption. And so for him, his tieflings, they're going to actually have the same ability score increase, +2 to charisma, +1 to intelligence. But instead of Infernal Legacy, he has the legacy of Maledomini. And so here they get the Thaumaturgy cantrip as normal. And at third level, they instead get Ray of Sickness, which is a great second level spell. And then at fifth level, instead of darkness, they get Crown of Madness. So all of this is corruption idea and decay, basically. So Crown of Madness is a really great spell that basically charms a target, but instead of doing what you want, it just does whatever. It basically has, if you get affected by that spell, you have to use your melee attack to attack a creature other than yourself that is directed by the person charming you. So basically you just like turn on your allies, and you're kind of in this like kind of illusionary twisted crown of jagged iron shows up on your head as the madness glows in its eyes.
I mean, that's great for a chaotic alignment. Anybody love it.
It's kind of like confusion but a little less so, but basically it just turns people against their friends, which is kind of, you know, Beelzebub's kind of thing. What's interesting too about all these lords of the nine hells, some of them come from actual history. Beelzebub was a Canaanite deity and is referenced in the Bible, in Old Testament, and I believe the New Testament, and he's called the Lord of the Flies, which is the book of the same name, but is kind of like a god of like rain and decay and stuff. It's kind of muddy, but they've chosen to include
rain,
him here.
Muddy.
Okay.
Sorry, right. You left that one wide open.
You can have advantage on your next roll. That was pretty good. So that's the Beelzebub one. And so this is kind of setting up the typical flow for all of these variant tieflings is the ability score changes. Instead of Infernal Legacy, it becomes Legacy of X. And they change out the spells to kind of fit inside the portfolio of what that Lord of the Hells is kind of concerned with. So then
I kind of like to think of the tieflings like great grandpappy being a warlock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this whole thing is you made a deal with the devil and now you're cursed because of it.
Yeah. He's looking at warlocks like, you want tiefling kids? Because that's how you get tiefling kids.
Yeah. Or like the tieflings that are really concerned about the warlock that's in their adventuring party.
They're like,
yeah. Don't do it, man.
Yeah, man. Listen, did you read all the fine print? Because, yeah. So the next one is Dispater. Dispater occupies the city of Dis. Dispater.
I feel like there's so many jokes in there.
Oh, yeah. There are, actually.
It's like a who's on first joke waiting to happen in your campaign.
New plane, who dis? Yes. What? the second layer of hell, this is a place where secrets are uncovered and shared, often to the highest bidder. And so the tieflings of Dispater, they are excellent spies and infiltrators. It's all about secrets. And so they get a +2 to charisma and a +1 to dexterity, which is kind of fun, going with your kind of roguish archetypes there. They still know the legacy of Dis, so they still know...
I'm oh sorry.
My gosh. We'll never finish the episode.
Dis legacy. It's Dis legacy. The legacy of Dis. I will legacy hold it together.
Dis. Legacy of what? Dis. They still know the Thaumaturgy cantrip. And when they reach third level, they get Disguise Self, which is kind of fun.
Oh, makes sense.
And then fifth level, they get Detect Thoughts, which is also really rad.
Also makes sense with secrets.
Yep. And all of those are per long rest. And of course, charisma still being the spellcasting modifier. Then we have the Firna. Tiefling. Firna is one of the lords of the hells. I think of the same name. I don't have it in front of me, but Firna is a master manipulator. And so it's all about kind of manipulating people to get what you want. It's about control, oftentimes direct, but sometimes also indirect through social things. And so they're actually going to get a +2 to charisma and a +1 to their wisdom score, which is really interesting. And they don't get Thaumaturgy. They get the Friends cantrip because no one told them life was going to be this way. And then the third level, they get the Charm Person spell. And then at fifth level, they get the Suggestion spell. And again, once per long rest, charisma for the spellcasting modifier.
Sounds really good for somebody that wants to buddy up to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not on the up and up at all.
It'd be fun to like make that person like a lady in waiting or something to like the queen or one of those kind of jobs, or that's like how you started. I don't know. There's a lot
there. That.
I think it's fun.
That's really good. Yeah. And so the next one is going to be the tieflings of, I lost it. All right. Tieflings of Glaza. Glaza is Hell's criminal mastermind. And so it's all about that heist for Glaza. Go ahead. Do it.
No.
No. Come on.
I was just thinking that I really like the fact that she is the criminal mastermind here.
Yes. Yes. As often is the case. Do, 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 do. So charisma +2 is normal. Dexterity +1, which makes a lot of sense, going back to that kind of other roguish thing about secrets and being a spy. For them, they get the legacy of Malbolgi.
This sounds like a pasta dish.
Legacy of Malbolgi. Yeah, sure. I'm going to stand by that. So they get for their cantrip Minor Illusion, third level, Disguise Self, which sounds familiar. And then fifth level, the Invisibility Spell.
Whoa, awesome. Nice.
Yes. Again, same rules as before about long rest and charisma, which is really fun. Now, this next one is really interesting, and I'm actually kind of excited about this one. So this is the Tieflings of Levistus. Levistus is rules the plane of Stygia. Now, Stygia is kind of a wild plane of hell because it is a frozen tundra. It's super cold. And
that's an interesting dichotomy from your usual stereotype.
It is, but there are ice devils in the Monster Manual. And so they got to live somewhere. So they live in Stygia. And this, I think Stygia comes from Greek mythology, actually, because it's related to the river Styx. It's like kind of separated by that. And so they actually are known, Vistas is actually known for being a deal maker, oftentimes for people who are facing a certain doom. And so it's like, you know, you're in that foxhole, you know, you're about to die, you're between a rock and a hard place. And Levistus is the one who shows up to make that deal, which is really funny because there is a warlock evocation called Armor of Levistus. Yeah, I think it's called that. That name checks Levistus basically in the evocations. And what it does is it creates a temporary ice shield for the warlock. I'm actually double checking Tomb of Levistus. Yeah, it's a reaction. Ooh, that basically—
that's even more ominous.
Yes, isn't it? Yeah, it basically, when you take damage, you can protect yourself by covering yourself in ice. But again, that lore kind of getting everywhere inside of all of these things. And so so they make packs, they make deals with people. They're from an ice part of the Nine Hells. And sure enough, the warlock gets a thing that does ice stuff that has Levistus's name in it. So I love
it. Warlocks.
All, yeah, it's all coming together. Exactly. Maybe that's too high a price to pay for a 1d10 cantrip. So their ability score increases, charisma plus 2, constitution plus 1, which is
living in a freezing plane.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. And they have the legacy of Stygia. They learned the Ray of Frost cantrip, which is not surprising. Third level, they can cast the Armor of Agathys, which is a similar kind of thing. It's a second level spell. And then at fifth level, they get the Darkness spell, which is kind of like our stock tieflings as well. They don't get Tomb of Levistus because that's not a spell. It's a warlock pack feature or evocation feature. So, yeah. Then the next one is we have Mammon, the Tieflings of Mammon. And Mammon is great because going back to kind of biblical lore, Mammon was another word for money, usually a derogatory term for money. When Jesus says the love of Mammon is the root of all kinds of evil, he's meaning the love of money is the roots of all kinds of evil. And so Mammon, one of the lords of the Nine Hells, is a miser and loves coin and gold and
Scrooge
riches.
Scrooge McDuck.
Yes. He was super evil. so his kind of, I hate to say blessings, his tieflings, basically they're about guarding and gaining wealth. And so
they're the tax collectors in your city. Ooh,
yeah.
Ooh, that would be good.
Ooh, that's really good. Because he lives on the plain of Minoros, which is where Minotaurs come from, who guard and protect things in mazes, right? So it's all kind of coming together. But yeah, tax collector. Oh, that'd be so good. And they already hated by everybody.
Their intimidation to begin with, like they're just gonna get what's due them, and they're probably going to up it a little bit so that they can throw some to their demon mm-hmm. god, as well as take a little for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so good. So they have actually a stock ability score increase. They have plus 2 to charisma, plus 1 to intelligence. And then they have the Legacy of Minoros, which is a mage hand cantrip. Third level, they get Tensor's Floating Disc. Which is interesting because Tensors is a first level spell, not a second, like you usually would see at this level. But Tensors Floating Disc can actually be refreshed either on a short or a long rest. So you get to use it more often. So that's the kind of change up there.
Okay.
And then at fifth level, they can cast Arcane Lock as their spell once with no material component. Only on a long rest, though. And so that kind of magically seals up chests and doors and treasuries and that kind of thing.
That one makes a lot of sense. I'm still trying to place Mage Hand. How does that one fit into this idea? Like, it's not really a pickpocket because that's not necessarily like this kind of domain.
Money, please.
Just like Mage Handing out because you don't want to get too close.
Yeah, but no, but I mean, okay, there are like arcane tricksters and things and rogues and stuff, but like you can still pick up something up to, what was it, 5 pounds, 15 pounds, I forget now, for Magehand, and you could collect the taxes with that. You know, you can grab things up to 30 feet away. Yeah, it's a max of 10 pounds.
That's a mammon tiefling that can just like sit there jamming out on the street corner while mage handing for money.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it walks around with the hat, you know, like busking, like just, you know, or when people aren't looking, it just takes their lunch, you know. So yeah, so a mage hand, I think it works pretty thematically well. So then we have, this one's just fun to say, the the Mephistopheles tiefling. So Mephistopheles is going to be one who focuses on arcane power. And so his tieflings master arcane magic. And also his realm is kind of also cold. So their legacy is the legacy of Kania, and they get Magehand. Third level, they get Burning Hands. And then on fifth level, they get the Flame Blade spell. And each of those is long rest, and their ability score is stock. So that's +2 charisma, +1 intelligence. And then I'm going to skip down to the last one from Mordekainen's, which is the Zariel tiefling. So Zariel is the lord of the first level of the Nine Hells, Avernus. The book that came out not too long ago. And what's interesting about Zariel is Zariel used to be an angel, like straight up divine smites, I'm going to kill all the evildoers, and was corrupted and kind of tricked, misled by Asmodeus into being the new lord of Avernus, which is really, really interesting. And so her tieflings are the most different, perhaps, that we've seen so far. So a +2 to charisma, a +1 to strength, thaumaturgy cantrip. Third level, they can cast Searing Smite, which is typically going to be a paladin spell, but they get it as a second level spell they can do once per long rest. And then at fifth level, they can cast Branding Smite. You're starting to notice the idea there. Once per long rest with that, and charisma, of course, being the spell casting ability modifier.
This reminds me of Moana. When Maui's like, I will smite you. Do you want to be smoten?
Smitten? Yeah.
And so, it makes sense with the paladin trait. Like if it kind of comes from a, you know, if you want to call it a fallen angel or a, you know, corrupted angel, however you want to see that, like that tie-in makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because it's the whole theme with her is, you know, that I will punish the wicked thing taken to an extreme. So where it's not about divine justice, it's just kind of about anger. It's just about destruction. And so that's the kind of the corruption happening there. And so having the smite spells being kind of the natural things is really awesome. And I would love to see a paladin be played by a Zariel tiefling.
Yeah, it's like the Punisher without a code.
Yeah. And I'm not, and man, the Punisher does not have a strong code in the first place. So, yeah. And then the last one is not from Mordekainen's. It's actually from everyone's favorite book that they don't know about, The Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide. And so these are they call them the Feral Tiefling. But the idea here is that, well, since all tieflings from the Player's Handbook are from Asmodeus, how about we give some variations among the different tieflings from Asmodeus, because he is the lord of all the Nine Hells, not just his plane of it. So he is a bit beefier, more potent, as it would, as it were. And so they even give you some different options to choose as far as like features and things, like smaller horns or a forked tongue or cat-like eyes or 6 fingers on each hand, goat-like legs, forked tail, leathery or scaly skin, and red or, oh, here it is, dark blue skin.
Ah.
or that they cast no shadow or have no reflection, or they always smell like brimstone. So there's a bunch more options in there. Again, just giving credence to the, do what you want when it comes to the way your tiefling looks. And these are kind of wild. So what's interesting here is that with these, you can choose any of these three variations, but you can't choose more than one. You just have to do this. And so the first one is the devil tongue variant. So they get to know the vicious mockery cantrip. At third level, they get charm person. And then at fifth level, the enthrall spell. It's a per long rest charisma. This is a spell casting ability, and it replaces the infernal legacy trait. And all these do that. They replace that infernal legacy trait, like we saw with all the ones from Mortar Cannons. And then we have the Hellfire variant. At third level, they kept burning hands, and that's it. All it does
That's all I got.
Yeah, burning hands. That's it. So what it basically does, the Hellfire one, instead of Hellish Rebuke in Infernal Legacy, it just swaps it out for Burning Hands instead of Hellish Rebuke. That's all it does.
Okay.
So everything else is normal. But
you still have your Thaumaturgy as well as your...
As well as Darkness, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it doesn't do as much changing, but I feel like there were some better ones we saw in, I think, what was it, Ferna that had that? No, was it Glazia? Mephistopheles. Yeah, I think that there's more interesting options there with Mephistopheles.
You just wanted a chance to say that name again, didn't you?
And redeem myself, yes. and then this is a cool one. Or the last one here for Asmodeus is a winged tiefling. So you have bat-like wings from the shoulder blades, flying speed of 30 feet, as long as you're not weighed down by like heavy armor or something. And that replaces the entire infernal legacy trait. You have no magic. You just have bat wings. That's it.
Huh, I can't decide if that's a blessing or a curse. I mean, no pun intended, right? But still.
Yeah, I know, because flying at first level is a big deal in D&D, and they rarely do it. I think only the Aarakocra are the other like really like common race that can just fly at first level. Even some of the Genasi can only like levitate limitedly. At first level, and so they make you give up a ton of stuff in order to have this one thing.
I mean, just pair it with a really good class.
Yeah, exactly. But that's intimidating as heck. Like, you already got the whole...
You got the horns and the tail, and then now you have bat wings.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you could just terrorize an entire town at night. Like, make them think a full-on demon is there, and they're like leaving offerings and sacrifices. Like, that could go bad fast. Or great, depending on who you are.
So the Feral Tiefling is not a sub-race. It is its own race.
Yes and no. It's like all the others. They're sub-races. They're variations Tiefling. But they are sub-races in that way. But yet they do a little bit different things than most typical sub-races, where it's not about like, here's all the stocked stuff plus this. It's replacing some things from the stock instead of just adding things from the stock.
Right. I think it's confusing as is, because I know on D&D Beyond that it's actually listed as its own race choice.
Right. And that's why, because it replaces things from the base model instead of adding things from the base model. And that
they all do.
No. Well, all the tieflings do. Yeah. But like none of the other races do that. And so even from like getting really meta here, like the way that the computer program is going to handle that is different. So it ends up being a different sub race. Different race altogether, not a sub-race.
Oh, there's so much good stuff to play with here. And so lastly, now that we have these 6 million different types of tieflings that you can play, Let's do our pairing suggestions. I mean, and I think this is going to be really fun because you can go super expected with like, well, you're a rogue or you're a thief because that's what people expect you to be. That was the only opportunities that you got. Or you can go with the, I'm going to prove you wrong and be the paladin or be, you know, some of these other things. And yeah. So it, the playing field's wide open, but what are some of your favorite combinations?
Yeah. So the most common combinations, especially coming from just the player's handbook, is going to be warlock, is going to be sorcerer, bard as well, because the high charisma is really, really great. The things you're going to see oftentimes. And then, but when it comes to all the options from Mordekainen's and Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, you can play whatever you want, just whatever you want. Like, I can't wait to see a barbarian Zeriel tiefling or a paladin Zeriel tiefling that have those like innate smites and the bonuses to strength and stuff. I think that would be phenomenal. Where they just come in red skin and horns raging, and then all of a sudden, you know, channel infernal smiting power through their greatsword and take someone down. I'm just like, that's horrifying. I love that. So basically, when it comes to tieflings, do what you want.
Thanks for listening into the compendium. This particular episode was sponsored by The Critical Dice and The Endless Bag of Dice. If you are a dice lover like me, this is an awesome service because you can actually get a brand new set of dice delivered directly to your doorstep every single month for as low as $6.99. Compendium listeners can actually get a special offer by using the code COMPENDIUM, that's COMPENDM, at checkout for their Endless Bag of Dice for 50% off that first month of dice. That's seriously dice as low as like $3. Just go to thecriticaldice.com and use the code COMPENDIUM at checkout. We hope that you guys enjoyed listening in this week. If you haven't already, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Jason and I really enjoy creating this content, and it definitely helps boost our charisma modifier every time we see a 5-star rating pop up. The Compendium is also on Patreon, so if you like listening, that is a great way to contribute to the content that we create. New episodes are available every Tuesday and Friday, or if you're a patron, you get them a day early, so Mondays and Thursdays. And you can always keep up with us between episodes by following us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look us up by searching for The Compendium. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.